This land is your land. This land is mine. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Peltier. Leonard Peltier is an imprisoned First Nations person and is considered by Amnesty International, SCLC, the Archbishop of Desmond Tutu, the Robert F. Kennedy Memorial Center for Human Rights, and many others to be a political prisoner who should be released immediately. Leonard Peltier is serving two consecutive life terms in a federal penitentiary in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania, for the deaths of two FBI agents during a 1975 shootout on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. Leonard Peltier has been in prison for approximately 30 years. And today with us is Peltier's former defense legal team attorney, Michael Kuzma. Michael, thank you for joining us today.
Oh, and thank you for having me this evening.
I understand that you were part of Peltier's defense legal team for about 6 years and that you recently have withdrawn as counsel of record. How did you get involved with the Peltier case?
Well, for years I was interested in the American Indian movement and how it had been targeted by the FBI under its counterintelligence program. And I had written letters, I had lobbied members of Congress and such. I actually went to Washington 1 year and Senator Inouye from Hawaii spoke to our little group. And it would have been the spring, I believe, or early 2001, Gina Chiala, who at the time headed the Leonard Peltier Defense Committee, which back then was based in Lawrence, Kansas, asked if I would be willing to take over the coordination of efforts to obtain Leonard Peltier's files from the FBI under the Federal Freedom of Information Act. Up until that time, Jennifer Harberry had been handling those matters. Harberry's a renowned human rights attorney. Her husband was actually murdered by U.S.-trained death squads in Guatemala.
Whoa. Well, why did you decide to withdraw as counsel of record from Leonard Peltier's case?
Well, I had, in 2001, I started making a FOIA request. Those, and we can discuss that further as the interview progresses. But there's been a lot of chaos within the Defense Committee, and on May 2nd, after talking to the director, and I believe now the former co-director, I decided it was time to maybe move on. But I am helping Ron Kuby, who was Bill Kunstler's protege, handle the case. Ron Kuby and his young and able associate, David Pressman, will be handling the FOIA appeal, which is pending in the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is in St. Louis. A brief is due in that case on June 8th, a week from Friday.
So your withdrawal from the case has nothing to do with the merits of Peltier's case?
No, I firmly believe Leonard Peltier was railroaded. There's no doubt in my mind that the government withheld evidence and pretty much framed Leonard Peltier. The government has publicly admitted through a now-retired U.S. attorney, Lynn Crooks, that they don't know who shot the two agents. And
well,
Leonard
Yes. You know, Robert Robert Redford did a documentary in 1992, the incident at Oglala. Yes. And I would like to first start by examining the background with the Wounded Knee incident that began in February 27, 1973, which incidentally does involve AIM, which you were discussing previously. I understand that Wounded Knee is basically a town on the Pine Ridge Reservation. It's the home of the Sioux Indians in South Dakota, and it also is the historical place for the massacre of over 150 Native Americans in 1890 by the United States military. So this is a place that certainly has a lot of history. And I understand that AIM, American Indian Movement, they entered the Wounded Knee. Could you tell us a little bit more of a background so people can understand how Leonard Peltier gets involved in this whole issue?
Well, the American Indian Movement was actually an urban movement. I was founded in Minneapolis in 1968, and it was a group of individuals had decided they were fed up with police brutality and such, and they would patrol the Indian ghettos, if you will, and ensure that Native rights of Native Americans were protected and the individuals were protected or safeguarded from police brutality. And the American Indian Movement members were actually invited to the reservation by the elders. And I think it's important for listeners to know that the movement didn't start on the reservations. It was more of an urban movement. And
right.
At Pine Ridge and other reservations around the country, American Indian Movement activists were actually invited to the reservations by elders or traditionalists.
Right.
And that's what happened in this case.
Yeah, the founders, Eddie Benign, George Mitchell, Dennis Banks, and Clyde Bellacourt, I believe.
Clyde Vernon Bellacourt, who are in based in Minneapolis.
Yeah, and they were invited by the elders at Pine Ridge. Could you tell us why they were invited?
Yeah, at the time there was a corrupt tribal government in place. Dickie Wilson was in charge, and he had assembled a group known as the Guardians of the Oglala Nation, or Goons for short, and the Goons were responsible for all types of violence and murders on the reservation. So the elders had invited the American Indian Movement to Pine Ridge to protect their people from these savage attacks and killings by members of the by Goon members.
And the Goon members were the Guardians of the Oglala Nation. They
That's
were
correct.
Responsible for basically slaughtering numerous First Nations. Of course, Richard Wilson was the president of the reservation. He seemed to wanted to, I don't know, it seems like there was a departure. Many of them wanted to stick with their own culture and their self-determination and autonomy. And then you have Richard Wilson on the other side, who seems to want to assimilate with the government, have the government, U.S. government, have more control of the First Nations people. That's how I gathered. Is that an improper characterization of it?
That's correct. And just so listeners are aware, I wasn't at the reservation. I was a young kid at the time a lot of this was occurring. But based on the many books I've read, that I would say that's a proper characterization of what occurred.
So,
getting to Leonard's case, what precipitated the firefight on June 26, 1975, is two FBI agents were allegedly looking for an individual who allegedly was wanted for stealing some cowboy boots. And they were following this vehicle that they believed had Jimmy Eagle in it. And they went on to the, they were on the reservation, and they went to the Jumping Bull property. And this firefight ensued. And when the smoke cleared, you had Agent Kohler and Agent Williams were killed, along with Joe Stuntz, who was also killed on June 26, 1975. And after the firefight, the government, you know, converged on the reservation and ultimately secured indictments against four individuals, Leonard Peltier being one of those individuals.
Well, let me just say that AIM, prior to that, AIM was seeking some help for with Pine Ridge Reservation, and they were calling upon First Nations around the world to help the First Nations. And one such person was the then 30-year-old Leonard Peltier. and he's from Grand Forks, North Dakota. And you were talking about these two FBI agents on June 26, 1975. Jack Kohler and Ronald Williams were these two agents, and they were looking for an individual named Jimmy Eagle, who drove a red pickup truck, and they were following a red truck, and it happened to be Leonard Peltier and two other AIM members. They jumped out of the vehicle, didn't they? And they started running.
FBI agents?
No. Leonard Peltier, I believe they were in the truck, and they...
It's my understanding the agents drove onto the reservation, a firefight ensued. Okay.
I thought that what happened was that they had jumped out of a truck and started running, and then the agents opened fire on Peltier and the two AIM members. It basically resulted in a fire. And this is really, really crucial because the prosecution's case seemed like they didn't take into consideration for this when it came to Peltier, but they did for the other two defendants in this particular case. I'm curious, after the gunfire, and I understand it was 125 shots that were fired, and it ended with both FBI agents, Kohler and Williams, shot in the head at close range. Now, there were three defendants afterwards. There was Leonard Peltier, and there was Robideau, and Dino Butler.
Yeah, Robideau and Dino Butler.
Right.
Now, what happened was Leonard Peltier didn't feel he could get a fair trial, so he, after the firefight, he left the area and was, this occurred on June 26, 1975. He was later arrested in Canada on February 6, 1976. Bob Robideau and Dino Butler they were arrested shortly thereafter and were tried. Leonard Peltier had elected to fight extradition back to the United States. So the trial against Dino Butler and Bob Robideau proceeded. They were represented by the late Bill Kunstler. And Bruce Ellison, I believe, was there. I forget the other attorney's name. But they were able to raise a self-defense argument. They were actually able to get the then FBI director on the stand, Clarence Kelly. They had the late Senator Frank Church from Idaho on the stand, who was able to discuss the FBI's now discredited counterintelligence program. And in an all-white jury in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, ruled or found that the defendants were not guilty on self-defense grounds.
Yeah, and William Kunstler represented both, as you were saying. He represented Robideau and also Butler, and these two individuals were acquitted July 16, 1976. But then you had the Peltier issue where the United States, and it seems that a lot of people in the law enforcement were upset that these two defendants were acquitted. And so do you think that they went after Peltier with great, with vengeance?
Well, what happened was after the jury reached its verdict in the Butler-Robideau case, the FBI actually analyzed what occurred. And they were determined to ensure that that didn't occur in Leonard Peltier's case. They felt the judge was too friendly to the defendants, that he allowed the judge, I believe his name was McManus, allowed the defendants to raise the self-defense and bring out the fact the FBI had engaged in these dirty tricks through its counterintelligence program. So they issued this report highlighting things that they felt they had done wrong in the Robideau-Butler trial. So they, took steps to ensure this wouldn't occur in the Peltier case. And Leonard Peltier was ultimately extradited back to the United States from Canada, and the basis for his extradition were these affidavits, these two perjured affidavits by the late Myrtle Poorbear. She recently passed away. Myrtle Poorbear was a mentally disturbed woman who claimed at the time to be Leonard Peltier's girlfriend. She claimed,
yeah.
among other things, that Leonard Peltier had told her he had killed the agents and that she had witnessed the crime. I mean, there were all these conflicting statements that Miss Poorbear made to the FBI. And based on the perjured affidavits, Leonard Peltier was brought back to the United States. And this time, the trial did not occur in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, but rather in Fargo, North Dakota. And the judge presiding over the trial was the late Paul Benson, who was a Nixon appointee. And Judge Benson, unlike the judge who presided over the trial of Robideau and Butler, didn't allow Leonard Peltier and his attorneys to raise the defenses that Butler and Robideau were able to raise.
Judge Benson also did not allow certain evidence in, evidence regarding Richard Dick Wilson's goon killing squad.
That's correct.
He didn't allow in. He didn't allow the history of violence toward the traditions, First Nations at Pine Ridge. He didn't allow evidence concerning Cedar Rapids trial. He didn't allow Myrtle Poorbear's perjured testimony. She had collectively three affidavits, and one of them, she says she never even met Leonard Peltier.
Well, the thing that's interesting about Myrtle Poorbear, she was ruled to be an incompetent witness, but I mean she was competent for the extradition proceedings. What's intriguing is under the Freedom of Information Act, we had obtained copies of the FBI 302s. Those are basically the interview forms, and if you compare the 302s to the affidavits that were proffered to the Canadian government, they contradict those as well. I mean, if you put all of these documents together, it would be clear that this woman was either, you know, making it up as she went along or was coerced to put some of these statements.
I understand that later she did admit that she was coerced by law enforcement to make these statements, and I guess that would only make sense, wouldn't it, considering you look at her affidavit and say, well, that doesn't make sense with this next one. This is not consistent with the other one. But you know, that was never grounds before the, well, it was actually before the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals.
Well, that was another case. We're sort of, jumping ahead. The 10th Circuit in a case recognized that, the 10th Circuit in 2003 stated in a written opinion, much of the
okay.
government's behavior at the Pine Ridge Reservation and in its prosecution of Mr. Peltier is to be condemned. The government withheld evidence. It intimidated witnesses. These facts are not disputed. And that was in Peltier versus Booker. So in 2003, the 10th Circuit did recognize that the government had engaged in all this improper activity, but nevertheless, the 10th Circuit, much like all the other courts, have refused to, free Leonard Peltier, or at the very least, order a
retrial. Yeah, and the court said it wasn't material, pretty much.
Along with countless other courts. I mean, what's fascinating about Leonard's 1977 trial is that most supporters are under the mistaken impression that Leonard Peltier was represented by William Kunstler. That's not the case. He was
right.
actually represented by an individual from New York by the name of Elliot Takeoff, who's now
yes.
deceased. He died in Ecuador in 1996. But Takeoff had never tried a murder case. The other intriguing thing is that most supporters are under the belief that the case was somehow mysteriously transferred to North Dakota. That's not correct either. Takeoff consented to have the case heard in North Dakota. Another thing that if anyone reads the original appeal in Leonard's case is Takeoff, without objection, allowed a lot of prejudicial evidence to come in to the trial. In fact, the Eighth Circuit highlighted that in its opinion. So there were a lot of tactical mistakes made at the time of trial in 1977. Bruce Ellison, who was co-counsel in the case, was a young man at the time. He was fresh out of law school. So I think you could argue there was ineffective assistance of counsel back in 1977.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, Judge Benson did allow a lot of favorable evidence to the prosecution. For instance, the judge did not outlaw the gory photos of the slain FBI agent. In fact, the judge said that the photos' probative value would not outweigh their tendency to prejudice the jury against the defendant. I thought that was really interesting. The judge says, "Oh well, you can let these photos in, but we're not going to allow Myrtle Poor Bear's perjured testimony in, or the evidence concerning Cedar Rapids in, or the Richard Dick Wilson's goon killing squad in. We're not going to let any of this in, but we are going to let these photos in." And I was really mystified me when I was reading the transcript, and I said, "Wow, that's utterly amazing." I'm curious, you know, Judge Benson had Leonard Peltier had some words for Judge Benson at the end of that particular trial.
I haven't read those in a while, but if you have those handy, I mean, those are definitely worth reading or referring people to.
Oh yes, you have to read them, because I think Leonard Peltier makes a wonderful assessment, not only for First Nations, but for people who have been objects of law enforcement surveillance and brutality. He doesn't speak only when I was looking at and reading, I said, you know what, a lot of what he's saying is what many people say in the Black Panther Party felt. Being surveyed, and other groups of people who were objects of basically the government surveillance, and quite often frame. And I know, as much as I am as an interviewer, I'm supposed to be objective, but I can't help but be moved by this case, Peltier, because it seems like this is a case that happens all too often to so many people.
Oh, what I've learned is, since I've gotten involved in 2001 on the legal side, is, you know, just getting back to the 1977 trial, at the time Leonard Peltier was tried, the prosecution merely turned over 3,500 pages of material to defense attorneys and said, "This is all we have." And as an attorney, you know, you're totally dependent upon the integrity of the prosecutor. You could have all kind of gut feelings and hunches and suspicions, but unless you have concrete evidence, you can't go to the court and say, "Look, I have reason to believe," or, "I just have this feeling the government's withholding information." So in Leonard's case, he's tried, convicted, given two consecutive, not concurrent, consecutive life sentences, and he's sent away. He first went to the notorious Marion prison in Illinois, and then later was transferred to Leavenworth, and now he's in Lewisburg. Well, fast forward to 79-80, Michael Tiger and John Privatera submit Freedom of Information Act requests to the FBI on behalf of Leonard Peltier. As a result of those FOIA requests, John Privatera and Michael Tiger learned that the FBI actually had 18,000 pages of material, 6,000 pages were withheld in their entirety.
Wow.
So that's a far cry from the 3,500 pages that were turned over at the time of the 77 trial. So for years, in fact, as a result of that request and subsequent lawsuit brought by John Privatera and Mike Tiger, Leonard Peltier and his attorneys became aware of this ballistics report that showed that the weapon that was linked to Leonard Peltier couldn't have possibly fired the shots that killed these two agents. And,
is that the .223 shell that was found?
Yes, that's correct. Where we had Evans Hodge giving the who prepared the report and then later gave conflicting testimony at a hearing in the district court before the same Judge Benson. But what's intriguing about this Privatera / Tiger FOIA request lawsuit is, for years, supporters were demanding that Congress or someone order the FBI to release those 6,000 pages of material. What we've now learned is that the government, as a result of these FOIA requests and subsequent lawsuits that Barry Bachrach and I filed in 2001 and 2002, that the government nationwide actually has 142,579 pages of material that were never released to Leonard Peltier or his defense attorneys. And
149,000?
Just get this, 142,579 pages of material. That's a far cry from the 3,500 pages that were turned over in 1977. So based on the sheer volume of material, how can you possibly say that Leonard Peltier got a fair trial? How can you defend yourself when these a room full of documents are still, to this very date, being withheld? And what's amazing, Malik, is that the Minneapolis office of the FBI was the office of origin for the investigation. Now, the investigation into the deaths of Kohler and Williams, keep in mind they never started an investigation into the death of Joe Stuntz, but the investigation of the deaths of Kohler and Williams was called the Resmers investigation. And Resmers stands for Reservation Murders.
Murders?
No.
Oh, okay.
Minneapolis alone has 90,000 pages of material. Barry Bachrach and I sued for those pages of material, and the government, maybe I should give a brief background to the Freedom of Information Act so there's no misunderstanding for the listeners. The Freedom of Information Act was signed into law on July 4th, 1966 by President Johnson. The law's been amended several times since then. It was strengthened in 75 over President Ford's veto, and it was weakened during the Reagan administration. And, of course, President Bush has done nothing to help administer the Freedom of Information Act. But the Freedom of Information Act allows any individual in the United States to request records from any agency. You don't have to give a reason as to why you want the records. And the agency, in theory, has 20 working days to provide the sought-after material. Now, the disclosure, not secrecy, is the dominant feature of the act. The act contains exemptions. These exemptions are permissive, not mandatory. There's an exemption for national security matters. There's an exemption for law enforcement records. For example, an agency can withhold records if it would reveal the identity of a confidential source. And a confidential source is broadly construed to include corporations and what have you, believe it or not. But these exemptions are permissive. They're not mandatory. Simply because material falls within an exemption doesn't mean the agency has to invoke the exemption. Now, in Leonard Peltier's case, what happened was we submit requests to different field offices that we thought would have records relating to Leonard Peltier. So we went after Minneapolis and Chicago and Milwaukee because that was the original office of origin before it was shifted over to Minneapolis, Los Angeles. Every field office that we sent requests to said, yes, we have records relating to Resmers and Leonard Peltier. These requests were all sent to Washington. So what happened then, the requests all go to Washington to FBI headquarters, and all of a sudden the FBI sends us a letter and says, we are not processing these requests anymore because Leonard Peltier has an unpaid copying bill of, I believe, $1,500, give or take a few dollars. So, and they said this was dating back to 1982. So we contested or disputed the validity of those charges. The FBI to this very day has not responded to my letter contesting those charges. So we paid those charges under protest. So then all of a sudden the FBI calls us, us being Bruce Ellison and John Pervitera and yours truly, and they want to cut a deal. They said that if we agreed to greatly reduce the scope of our FOIA requests, they would process the material quickly, but we would have
faster.
To agree never ever to submit a FOIA request to the FBI again on Leonard Peltier's behalf. And, of course, we couldn't agree to that. So during these conversations, and we were doing, a four-way call. The guy who was handling this, his name is Lawrence Shaver. He's an attorney with the FBI, and he's a hostage negotiator, and the hostages in this case are these FBI documents. So anyway, during the course of one of these conversations, I asked Mr. Shaver if he would tell us which offices did and did not have records relating to Leonard Peltier and or Resmers. And he says, oh, no, we can't tell you that. So we had to submit FOIA requests to each and every FBI field office in America. I believe there's 56. And lo and behold, every field office had a file relating to Leonard Peltier and Resmers. Even Buffalo, New York had a file, as crazy as that may seem. Birmingham, Alabama, Houston, Dallas, you name it, they had files. And the FBI, like I said, just like every other agency in theory, is supposed to provide the sought-after material within 20 working days. Based on my experience, not only in Leonard Peltier's case, but in other cases, the FBI never provides the material in 20 working days. Years is pretty typical in responding to requests. So in November of 2002, Barry Bachrach and I sued the FBI on Leonard Peltier's behalf in the U.S. District Court for the District of Minnesota. So we sue. What does the FBI do? Through their attorneys, they ask for what they call an Open America stay. And the government claimed that we're overworked and understaffed, so we need a stay. We need this case held in abeyance until December 2005. And the court granted that. Now, keep in mind, the original request was in 2001. We didn't file the suit until 2002. And the court gives them until 2005 to process this material.
Give them four more years.
That should have been turned over in 1977 at the time of Leonard Peltier's trial. So the government processes all this material, and they withhold 10,555 pages on national security grounds. And they also, they claim, and this is an exact quote from a declaration by David M. Hardy. He's the chief of the section chief of the Freedom of Information section. He said that he's claiming that if they release this information, it would have a chilling effect on the free flow of vital information to the intelligence and law enforcement agencies and cause serious damage to the national security of the United States and the war on transnational terrorism.
Let me ask you something. I think the listeners can see the frame, Leonard Peltier being framed. Do you think at this particular time with, the Freedom of Information Act and their stubbornness to turn it over in a timely manner or turn much over at all, do you think this is part of the cover-up?
Oh, without a doubt. I think there's a lot of stuff in these files that the FBI would prefer never saw the light of day. I think it's like the Kennedy assassination or the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King. I think those files are what sealed and for another, 30, 40 years? And I think the same is true in this case.
Why do you think
they would just as soon have this lawsuit go away and have these files disappear?
Why do you think that the government framed Peltier?
I think, based on my work on the case over the past 6 years, it's my belief that the FBI, through its now discredited or its long discredited counterintelligence program directed against the American Indian Movement and the Black Panthers, I believe COINTELPRO set the wheels in motion, which culminated in the deaths of Joe Stuntz and Agents Kohler and Williams. You had the American Indian movement had been heavily infiltrated by FBI operatives and such, and I think if all the files relating to this case were released, you would see that an FBI plant probably set the wheels into motion, and as a result, three people lost their lives on June 26, 1975.
Yeah. I look at it very simply. Two dead FBI agents, enraged FBI, three defendants, two acquitted. The only one left is Paltier. The revenge factor of the FBI goes after Paltier. Were you aware in 2004 of Bob Robideau's statement about the 1975 killing? He said, quote, "They were shot in the head at close range, but they were killed honorable. I have no remorse for the actions we took against our enemies in the heat of this defensive action." Then Bob Robideau later stated, "I am Mr. X, and I did kill them with the honor befitting a warrior, but they died like worms," end quote. Do you think that was just Bob Robideau, who was one of the defendants initially acquitted, do you think that he was just saying that just to get a rise out of the FBI?
To be honest, I don't know what to think of that statement. I've maybe read it briefly once, but I think Bob would be the best person to answer that question.
One other thing I want to say before, because there are callers who want to speak with you and ask questions of you. Paltier is going to get a parole in December of 2008, and something struck me as strange why the parole commission would not allow him to get a hearing earlier than that, and the basis was that Paltier has never admitted to killing the FBI agents. That's the reason why they would not allow him to get a hearing before December 2008. Well, if he admitted to something like that, then wouldn't that be basis to deny him a parole at all?
Well, there was actually a few years back, there was a parole officer, and I don't recall all the specifics, but he actually recommended that Leonard Peltier be released on parole, and his findings were rejected, and I believe he was ultimately terminated or forced out of the parole commission. But they just so listeners are aware, there is a lawsuit pending. It was filed on March 5th of this year. Leonard Peltier is suing the Bureau of Prisons and the U.S. Parole Commission in the U.S. District Court for the Middle District of Pennsylvania. Now, parole has been abolished at the federal level. It was abolished in 1984. Leonard Peltier came into the system pre-1984.
Right.
He's one of the old law inmates. So the law didn't change for individuals such as Leonard Peltier and others convicted pre-1984. And under the law that's applicable to Leonard Peltier, it's our position and Leonard's position that he's entitled, as he likes to call it, the mandatory release complaint. Now, Ron Kuby and David Pressman are lead counsel now on this case, and we're waiting for the government's response. But we're arguing that Leonard's, after 30 years, they pretty much have to cut him loose. They're the one fly in the ointment, and you could devote a whole show to it, is that not only is Leonard Peltier serving two consecutive life sentences, he also has, I believe he had 4 to 7 years tacked on for an attempted escape while he was incarcerated in Lompoc, California, or Lompoc, as some people pronounce it. So that sort of muddies the water. But nevertheless, Leonard's been incarcerated since February 6, 1976. He's been in over 31 years, and we believe the law that is applicable to Leonard Peltier mandates that he be released without further delay.
Immediately. We are speaking to Michael Kuzma, who's a former defense attorney for Leonard Peltier. I know many people are calling. I see that the lines are filling up. They have a lot of questions for you, Mike. Are you up to it?
Yeah, especially if they're Freedom of Information Act questions, fire away.
Okay. You may ask your questions, call toll-free number. I'm pretty sure that everybody's aware of the toll-free number. Just in case you're not, it's 888-861-3519. Again, that's 888-861-3519. We have one such person, Mike.
Yeah.
From California. Please state your, come and ask a question of our guest, please.
Michael, thank you for coming on the show. I wanted to know, is there anything that or the ordinary common citizen or international citizen can do to help free Mr. Peltier? Is there a website? Is there an address? You know, you were talking about the Freedom of Information Act. What can we do via fax or email or et cetera to help this guy out? I mean, last week on this program, I heard Mamia Abu-Jamal's attorney speak and offer suggestions on freeing Mamia. What can we do to free Mr. Peltier? Thank you.
I caught part of it. Was the question, what can supporters do to help free Leonard?
Yes, he wanted to know what could we do to help free Leonard. Also, he wanted to know if some websites or some contacts that
people
could make.
Well, the official website is Leonard Peltier. And that's one word, Leonard Peltier, PELTIER.net. So it's LeonardPeltier.net is the official site. Else, who's in Belgium, has a very good site on MySpace. So it's MySpace.com/LeonardPeltierIsInnocent. That's a fabulous site. There's videos and such on that site. So I would recommend, and Else in Belgium is working with the Leonard Peltier Defense Committee. But what I've urged people to do, because my primary concern over the past 6 years has been fighting to get these FBI files, the supporters in Boston actually had success. They worked with Congressman Barney Frank, and as a result of their efforts, they got the entire headquarters file of the FBI relating to Resmers turned over to the National Archives. In addition, a courtesy copy was provided to the Defense Committee. So I would continue to push for the full liberation of the Resmers/Leonard Peltier files. I would work, and it, actually, if you go to the LeonardPeltier.net website, there's a list showing what field office has how many pages. So if you have a supporter or two, you can meet, arrange a meeting with your local representative in the House and or your two senators and ask them to fight for the release of the files. Like in California, for example, Marlon Brando was a big supporter of the American Indian Movement. In fact, if you read the book by Dennis Banks, Ojibwe Warrior, you'll see that after the firefight in June of 75, Dennis Banks and Leonard Peltier actually ended up at Marlon Brando's home, and at that time, Marlon Brando gave Dennis Banks and Leonard $10,000 in cash in his motorhome. So there's some massive files in Los Angeles and San Francisco relating to Resmers and Leonard Peltier that have yet to be released. And I think these files contain the secret that could, or the key that could open the door to Leonard's prison door.
Well, thank you, Mike. Well, I like to say to Mike from California, not only is there LeonardPeltier.net, you have LeonardPeltier.org as well, which is a good website.
Yeah, you have Free Peltier. The old website is FreePeltier.org. It has a lot of older material, which is quite good, but the official current site is LeonardPeltier.net.
Also, Peltier wrote, he's written a couple of books. Isn't one Prison Writings, My Life is My Sundance?
Yeah, with Harvey Arden. Another great book, I believe, is Agents of Repression by Ward Churchill, the chapter devoted to, or the sections devoted to the American Indian Movement. I'd say it's probably one of the better books out there. For background information, Ojibwe Warrior by Dennis Banks is quite good. The autobiography by Russell Means, Where White Men Fear to Tread, is worth reading. Another book by Ken Stern, U.S. versus Loud Hawk, I would definitely recommend reading. It's definitely worth the read.
Thank you, Mike, from California. We have another caller. Judith from South Dakota. Please come and ask Mike a question.
Hello, is someone there?
Yeah, I think the Judith's main... Here she is. Well, Judith, we couldn't understand a thing. Judith, we couldn't understand a thing you said. It was da-da-da-da-da. Let me translate that for you.
So what
she wanted to know... Michael, what she wanted to know was, are there any senators who... I understand that Clinton, they try to get a pardon from Clinton. Are there any other representatives, such as senators or anyone else who's involved in, or who we could push as citizens to urge the president now or the next president to pardon Peltier?
Apparently, David Geffen, who's with, was it DreamWorks, one of the big film companies, is a big Leonard Peltier supporter. Just recently, there was a big flap in the media how Geffen was supporting Obama over Hillary because... You know, Bill hadn't granted clemency to Leonard Peltier, or hadn't pardoned Leonard. And I know Leonard is urging supporters to get behind Obama. So I think if people encounter Obama on the campaign trail, or if they live in Illinois, they may want to meet with his representatives. I'm a big Dennis Kucinich guy, unlike Leonard. But I actually met Dennis Kucinich in Cleveland last May, and I talked to him. He was actually being primaried and not being supported by the local paper. But I asked Dennis if he would do something. Unfortunately, he hasn't followed through on it. But Barney Frank's a friendly for anyone in Massachusetts listening. Dennis, I think, is just, I know he's running around on the campaign trail, but I think Obama... And Dennis Kucinich and Barney Frank and I would think Bobby Rush maybe out of Chicago would be good, would be a good start. But Barney Frank already has a track record. He was more than helpful on getting those headquarters records released.
We have another caller, Mia Fugasa from Texas. Mia, please come and ask a question of Mr. Kuzma.
Hello?
Hello, Mia.
Hello. Is it you, Wu?
I can hear
yes,
you.
Yes, we hear you. We can hear you.
Okay. I would like to ask a question. I don't know too much about that case, so I don't want to embarrass myself and ask just as I'm
There's no to. Such thing as a stupid question. Go ahead.
I'm going to ask this question. If there is any native attorneys, because I have not seen any. Probably there are any. I don't know. Is that a question to ask?
No, that's a good question. I mean, I've always been troubled by the fact there are no Native or Aboriginal attorneys involved. I think it would actually be quite helpful because when you go into court, for the most part, Leonard's attorneys have been, you know, they're all, with the exception of Jennifer Harberry, you've had white males, and most of them have been from New York, Barry Bachrach being from Worcester, Massachusetts. But I think the courts may look at it differently if there were young Native attorneys, you know, in the forefront. I think it would be, symbolically, would be very important, and I think the courts would be, I mean, as bad as they are, I think they would be less likely to dismiss the arguments. I think a lot of times, you come into court, whether it's me or whoever, and they just, the courts or the system just thinks this is radical chic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just some white liberal cause or some fringe cause. So I think it would be very important for Native attorneys to get involved. I spoke at Cornell Law School a couple of years ago. The Native American Law Student Association had me come down, And I would be more than happier to help out some young Native attorney who was gung-ho on getting involved, and unfortunately, no one's, stepped up to the plate. But I think that's a great question, and it saddens me that no Native attorneys have come forward to offer to help.
Thank you, Mia. We have another caller, Lynn from Florida. Lynn from Florida, come up and ask your question, Mr. Guzman. Mike, I call you Mike, and I call you Mr.
Yeah,
Guzman. It doesn't bother you.
Formal. I'm Mike.
What's
yes, Lynn from Florida. What's happening?
Hi, Mike. I hope you can hear me, Mr. Kuzma. I guess in this case, I should use my name Leonard. Anyway, my question is, given the recent scandal, the Abramoff scandal, that showed how much influence the tribal leaders could have in our government with things relating to making casino deals and the like, what kind of other political pressure have tribal organizations put on politicians to exert political pressure, say, through the Native Affairs Committee? Anyway,
I was hitting bits and pieces, Malik. Could you fill me in?
As I understand, Leonard asked, what type of pressure are tribes putting on, I understand, our politicians and representatives to help Native people?
Here in Buffalo, we're near the Seneca Nation. I've actually met, they have a lot of clout now because of the casinos and the smoke shops and what have you. And I mean, just to focus on Leonard specifically, with the exception of one of the smoke shop owners bringing in Leonard's artwork and displaying it at a hall that he has next to his smoke shop, they haven't stepped forward and have applied any kind of political pressure on Leonard's behalf. In February of this year, I met in Toronto Phil Fontaine, who's the, if you will, president of First Nations in Canada. And Phil Fontaine actually had an opportunity to speak briefly to Leonard. And he's offered to assist. He's been a strong supporter of Leonard Peltier. But I don't believe there's been any follow-up. But I think there's a lot of potential there, at least in Leonard Peltier's case, and unfortunately a lot of the nations haven't done as much, haven't used their political capital or financial to bring about some changes or some forward movement in Leonard Peltier's case.
We have another caller, Henry. Henry from Mississippi. Henry, please come up and ask your question.
Thank you, Vu. This is actually for a friend of mine named Dreema. She is wondering, what is the excuses given by the government not to release documents on Leonard's case under the Freedom of Information Act of 2000?
What reasons have they used? They've used, in Minneapolis and Buffalo, they claim that they can't release these files because it would harm the nation's or hamper the nation's war on transnational terrorism. That's the B1 exemption. The other exemption they've used extensively is the law enforcement exemption, B7. And they primarily rely on B7C to delete the names of FBI personnel. In addition, they use the confidential source exemption, claiming that, in fact, there's an entire subfile in Minneapolis called the subfile N. N is in Nancy, and that's the informant file. But they claim that they cannot release this material, even though it's over 30 years old, on those grounds. And it's our position that the exemptions are inapplicable. Also, we took the position that the document should have been turned over in 1977, that it was, if you will, Brady material. Unfortunately, all the courts that have heard our arguments have rejected them summarily.
Yeah,
the government fought. They would not even give us the documents that showed how much money they spent on confidential sources back in the early 70s. And the government invoked, I believe, the B-2 exemption, which is has to do with internal procedures and practices. And the court said we couldn't even get the dollar amount on how much they spent on informants.
So the government used the B-2 exemption, internal personal rules and practices, and also used the B-1 exemption, protects classified materials of national defense or foreign policy.
It was wild. Just, if I may, we were getting these periodic releases every few months. I'd get 6 or 12 boxes, big boxes, delivered to the office. And one day I get a call. In fact, it was after a visit. John Privatera, Barry Bachrach, and I had visited Leonard in Lewisburg. I think it was March. If it wasn't last year, it was the year before. But anyway, I get a call from the government, and they said, we inadvertently sent you a classified document. We want it back. And I said, you got to be kidding. Where is it? Oh, it's page number such and such. And I says, wait a minute. The stuff you're sending us doesn't have any page numbers. Well, to make a long story short, I found this so-called super secret document, and the government was so uptight, like put it in a double envelope and mail it FedEx and blah blah blah. And they said if you can't even talk about the contents of this document because it'll harm national security. All I could say is, If this is what they're worried about, this is what they're fighting to keep from the American public, it's laughable. It's a joke.
We have another caller, Point Dexter from Florida. Please come and ask your question.
Yeah, my question is, what is it about our justice system that allows...
There is no justice.
...compel them to resist exploring potential mistakes, even to the extent of allowing an innocent to be executed?
Well, if you go to law school, I mean, most of the people I went to law school with, I wouldn't want to represent me on most matters. And I, just so you know, I don't spend too much free time with attorneys. But look at who's on the bench. People are under this mistaken belief that judges, somehow or another, rise above politics, that they're these impartial triers of fact. But the reality is, in order to become a judge, you have to be the most political person on the planet. I'm actually fairly involved in Democratic politics here in Western New York, and the most political people become judges. And these individuals are going to do nothing to challenge the status quo or tip over any apple carts. They're going to go along to get along. And that's part of the problem. A lot of them are former prosecutors, and they're just rubber stamps for the status quo. It's really scary.
Wow.
I mean,
let me
I
ask
see
this question,
some of the people. I actually ran for city court. I had a sign, I had a clenched fist on it, and my logo was Justice for All People. And I see the caliber of people sitting on our town, village, and city courts. It's scary. It's frightening.
Michael, we have to wrap it up, but I wanted to ask you this. In law school, did you ever define the term justice? Because in all 3 years I went, we never defined that term justice.
Well, we never stepped into a courtroom in law school. It was incredible. We were at the University of Buffalo, which is not even in Buffalo. It's out in a swamp in Amherst, which is a first-ring suburb. People who've never practiced law teaching law school classes. It's scary.
Utterly. Thank you, Michael Guzma. Michael Guzma, thank you for being here, Pat.
Well, thank you for having me. It was a hoot. Wish we had some more time.
Yes, I wish. Will you come back?
Anytime. We could talk about the system, how rotten it is, not only in Leonard Peltier's case, but countless others. When justice happens, it's an accident.
I want to let the listeners know upcoming guests will be Angela Davis and Greg Palast. Thank you, Michael, for joining us.
Thank you again.
People speak. You take care.
Take care.
New York. Mm-hmm.